And welcome to the Milt Rosenberg podcast. It's called that because the fellow who's talking at the moment is indeed Milt Rosenberg. And what could we possibly talk about the day after the election but the election? And raise a few basic questions, which I will ask my guests to instantly address. The first is, we agree, 'twas a famous victory, and really in some ways a surprising victory in its extent. But the question is, why did it happen that way? How did they manage it? Or how did their opponents manage so poorly and squander whatever opportunities they might have had? And most important, what now? What should the Republicans be doing? What are they likely to do? What about the internal divisions? And will they, in fact, persist within the Republican Congressional Party, both in House and in Senate? So who are we putting those questions to? A very distinguished panel, two of whom have been here before, and one joins us for the first time. The new entrant is Kevin Lampe of the firm of Firth Lampe, and they are Democratic strategists. I love that
absolutely.
Term, as they use it in television news, cable news channels. Also with us are Chris Roebling, a mainstay of our old A-team, and he, also a public relations person, which Kevin Lampe really is on the political side. Chris is public relations on the corporate side and also, to be sure, on the political side, and was for many years the partner in the firm operated by Jane Thompson, the wife of former Governor Thompson, and now is running his own firm. And our third guest is Scott Stantis, the distinguished editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune and about 375 other newspapers around the world.
At least.
Also the proprietor of at least two comic strips.
Yes.
All right. Now come straight to it. We have to avoid, or at least not linger over, local issues because this is heard nationally and we trust internationally. But I know that your cartooning for the last day or two has focused on Springfield, Illinois. So explain just briefly why.
Well, I'm the cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune, and I want to keep my job. It really comes down to that. It's that simple.
What's the Illinois angle?
The Illinois angle is that nothing really changed here. We now have
a
Republican governor. This is true, but he's a very soft Republican, but as perceived by people at the right or far right, they would not call him a Republican at all.
Why do you say that?
Pro-choice, has very close connections with Democrats in the state. And frankly, if you want to get something done in Illinois, you better have those, I suppose.
And somebody said on the radio the other day, I forget who, and did not adduce the evidence, that the $16 million rather rapidly earned by the current mayor of Chicago was essentially from the coffers of now Senator-elect Rauner.
Well, that's not, it's not cheap to be...
Governor-elect Rauner.
Yes. It's not cheap to be part of their little wine group, It's $150,000 a year, for crying out loud. That money was handed back and forth. It's a good old boy network, and I'm not optimistic that things are going to move in the way that I think you and I would probably hope that they would.
Well, then the question is, will they move nationally? And Chris Roebling, you have a whole schedule of requirements that you want to now impose upon your fellow Republicans, those who carry or wear the senatorial mantle, and for that matter, who serve in the House, where the Republican numbers have expanded very considerably. What do you require them to do?
Well, I would say they have to communicate and they have to legislate. I mean, they are there at the federal level. The federal legislature is there to legislate, and I think they've got to be about that business, and they have to be seen as being about that business, and they have to talk about why they are doing it. And I'll throw out one other thing. I don't want those guys to stand in any shoes but those of the average American voter. I cannot emphasize enough the extent to which I think people are, first of all, I do think it is a categorical repudiation of Barack Obama's policies, and I'm sure we'll get to that. I also want to say there was a repudiation of business as usual. And so if you're throwing out business as usual, then you are looking for folks to do things differently. And I will say, having lived and worked in D.C. and having lived and worked out here in Chicago, I think one of the key requirements for success now is to show that your orientation is not that of D.C. and all of its sort of interlocking assumptions. Your orientation is back home.
I have been haunting the internet today, of course, and I've got loads of stories that I've printed out, and I carried some of them with me. And I read one to you right now. The headline, 100% of newly elected GOP senators campaigned on repealing Obamacare. I read you the first paragraph. Every newly elected GOP senator who won in last night's election campaigned on repealing Obamacare. Then they list all the senators. Cory Gardner, Republican Colorado, David Perdue, Oklahoma, Joni Ernst, Iowa, Tom Tillis, North Carolina, Tom Cotton, Arkansas, Langford, James Langford, Oklahoma, Daines, Republican Montana, Rounds, South Dakota, Shelley Moore, Capito, West Virginia, all ran on a platform of repealing Obamacare. Kevin Lampe, do you expect that they're going to start clamoring for that on the floor when they get the full Senate in January?
I think they'd be wise to first talk about the things that they can agree upon. Tax cuts, immigration reform. Find some things out of the gate where they can find some common ground between the president and themselves. Unfortunately, I don't think that'll happen. I think they will go after the red meat, or at least the loudest members in the Senate will go after the red meat. I do not envy Senator McConnell's challenge here of having to herd this group of cats. They're very opinionated, very loud, who have very limited agendas over the next 12 months.
There are a number of political divisions in American contemporary life. One is between Republicans and Democrats. Another, of possibly even greater interest, is between Republicans and Republicans. Is the struggle between those who are called traditionalist Republicans or whatever and those who are called radical Republicans, i.e. Tea Party Republicans, is that going to show up in bigger and stronger form now that they've got the majority in the Senate?
Well, it's already started to show up a little bit. Even last night, you heard people saying that Cruz is now going to run, the senator from Texas is going to run for majority leader. Of course, that's foolishness, but that was floated even last night. You have the likes of newly minted Senator Ernst from Iowa and others like that. It's going to be a battle. It always and the Democrats are facing the same thing. You have centrist Democrats who are going to be fighting with progressives, and the progressives are going to say, see, we told you you should have been more progressive, more radical, and we would have gotten more votes.
Well, will the first round of that battle between the two sectors of the Republican Party be over Obamacare and what to do about it?
Of course. And I think it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned that all of the Republicans who won ran opposing or talking
fully
about the repeal of Obamacare. I'm not sure that's a win. I'm sure Chris could probably address that. He probably has the numbers that can confirm or deny what my thoughts are, that there's elements of Obamacare people have grown to like already. But there's a lot that people have grown not to like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that repealing Obamacare is now a phrase that has evolved in its meaning to state keeping the parts we like and junking the parts we don't, and then bringing in a market-oriented, individually-based operation.
Ah, then, Christopher FitzHenry Roebling, are there any parts that you actually like in Obamacare?
No, I personally would say repeal the whole thing and do it the right way in terms of actually holding hearings and building a bill and having trying to gain some kind of consensus. I think that the great lost opportunity for President Obama, I've said this before, September of 2009, when all of the legislators went back to Washington after those big revolts and demonstrations at the home district tour, when all of the congressmen and the senators were out and they were being yelled at about a government takeover of health care. And it took and at that moment, Obama chose not to negotiate. He chose to stay hard left. I know my Democrat friends say, no, no, it's not hard left. It's really Mitt Romney. It's not Mitt Romney. It is hard left. And it is a total government takeover. And so what you end up with is pain until the spring of 2010 after the election of Scott Brown. And I believe that is the beginning of the rupture between Obama and the electorate, whose natural crescendo we saw last night.
The inevitable question, and to Kevin, is do you agree?
Well, as one of those people that has benefited from Obamacare, we went on a long time where we had no health insurance, and actually went through a couple of very serious health scares where in reality we would have been left to die without health insurance. We could not afford what the bills would have been. Luckily, things did not turn out the way they did. We now have access to health care that we never had before as a small business. One of the reasons we didn't expand our small business was because of access to health care at a reasonable price. I think the Republicans need to be very careful on where they tread. There's numerous things that the public really loves about it right now. There are things that definitely need to be fixed. In fact, I very much said at the time that I thought the Obamacare was just a good start. It was we needed to be adjustments, there needed to be changes, but it was somewhere moving along. I myself am in favor of a single payer system. I've seen it work successfully in Sweden in particular, where I do a lot of business. My Swedish business counterparts love the health system they have there, particularly the business owners, because they don't pay for it. They pay for it out of their taxes, yes, but they don't pay for it out of their corporate profits. I think this is going to be an emotional issue, and I think the president is going to stand firm on repealing Obamacare. And sometimes in politics, you got to pick the hills that you want to die on. And this hill may be too big of a hill for my friends across the aisle. Let's pick some hills where we actually could pound the size of those hills into plains and find some sense of agreement.
You are a political strategist. You are indeed a man of politics, not only in this country, but as you've indicated, and I've looked at the material in Sweden and many other countries around the world as well. I am a mere psychologist, and to be sure, a psychologist manquee. But let me pursue a psychological issue with you, Kevin, and with our two other guests as well. Quite simply, how much of the history of our time and of the last 6 years and the and of this this week and the election results, how much of it involves crucially the personality and thus the behavior and habits of the president of the United States, Barack Obama?
Oh, I think that's absolutely the narrative that's been strong here. And I think that what you saw happen last night was people fed up with and exasperated by the idea that even people, I think, who voted for him the first time and the second time, the hope, the talents that he had, the oratory skills that were, you know, reminiscent of Reagan, that they, he would be able to step forward and use the bully pulpit and be successful.
And his pants were more beautifully creased than Reagan's were.
Very beautifully creased. And he's an angular, handsome man.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, I'm comfortable enough to say
that. So what
that.
Went wrong?
I don't think he has the
or
chops
what is
to
wrong?
I don't think he has the chops to lead. I don't believe he's a leader. And I mean, and that's not a Democrat or a Republican issue. That's a practical issue. If you put this person in charge of your business, would he or she, in this case a he with Barack Obama, lead your business? And I think he has failed in that.
Chris Roebling, has he and why? And what does it have to do with his nature is what I'm really after.
Well, I have a hard time knowing his nature, but I will say that we're recording this the night after Election Day. So we saw Obama's press conference this afternoon.
I did, yes.
And in the press conference, I saw petulance. And I think I saw, I think I saw immaturity.
Was that the first time you saw petulance and immaturity from him?
No. But you would think after this kind of categorical and univocal repudiation of the policies he said were on the ballot. That was not a Tea Party press release. Barack Obama himself said, My policies are on the okay, fine. It's not just at the Senate. It was at the House. And then below that, it was at the governorships. And below that, we have these counties in Illinois, way down south, totally Democratic. They have been for generations. In Madison County, Illinois, a Republican was elected associate judge of the circuit court yesterday. It's unheard of. Franklin County, Illinois, a stronghold of the United Mine Workers. Bruce Rauner got 62% in Franklin County, Illinois. This is Bruce Rauner won St. Clair County by 1 point. This is and for Barack Obama to dwell on and to return to and to repeat his mention of, quote, I heard the two-thirds who didn't vote, and I understand you, as if to almost delegitimize the people who did vote. Kevin, is that what he was trying to do?
No. I understand you. He said that. You know what that reminds me of? A scene from another time with another great leader. Charles de Gaulle standing on the balcony in Algiers when the revolt was on and the native French Algerians were against independence for Algeria and were a civil war, in fact, was being waged. And he came down and standing on the balcony as they shouted and cheered and a great historical moment had arrived. No one knew what might come of it as Le Grand Charles suddenly is there. He says, "Je vous ai compris. I have understood you." But they did not understand him. Because, in fact, his intention was to go back and rather quickly get through the House of Deputies and so on, essentially a bill which gave Algeria its independence. He told the two-thirds, "I have understood you," you're saying. What has he understood about them?
Well, we have to wait for his next press conference, but here's what he didn't understand. He and his policies were repudiated definitively yesterday, and he needs to start over. And what I got instead was, "I'm just moving along. We're just going to keep going in the direction and at the rate that we've been going, and that's where we are."
And he will still have his phone and his fountain pen?
Yeah, the constitutional implications of what he said about, "I'm going to do what I want on immigration, but if the Congress does something else, it's going to wipe." I mean, I think real con law professors' heads were exploding.
Well, I want to come back to immigration. It's a crucial and fascinating area. But before we do, of course, let's turn to Kevin. I just simply repeat the question. What do you think the personality, as near as we can discern it, and the personality-based behavior from the president had to do with his defeat, with the Democrats' defeat yesterday?
I think one of the challenges that this administration has had is that the president needs to be more effective in talking about the things he has done well. They have not presented their side of their case up to and including particularly the Obamacare debate, and did not go out there and sell it and explain it and vet it fully, that they did not explain it as well as they could have. And he needed to go out there and talk about more what he was doing. He also needed to spend more time with the members of Congress. It was a missed opportunity, particularly in the first 2 years, and then more and more, particularly the second 2 years, where he needed to spend more time. He needed to take advantage and really sit down and take advantage of the talent he had in vice president, who understands more about the institution than most people in this country alive today do, and be able to understand what is going on and be able to explain and to help him to understand how he can work his agenda to it so that he can get things passed. He has one of the things that's frustrating about the president is he does have this steadfastness of opinion where he becomes immovable. And I think he needed to be able to go out there and to be able to talk to people who he needed to talk to, and he just missed that opportunity.
I watched that same press conference this afternoon, and I had a sort of grudging admiration for what I thought was a certain amount of resilience and a certain amount of toughness that he was showing, even though if I were he in that situation, I would be fighting back my tears.
Well, our good friend Charles Lipson wrote a great piece last night saying that both the Republicans and the president have to make quick, immediate decisions, and that meant today, about how they were going to face this challenge. The president had two choices to make. One, he could have been combative. The other one was he could have been complacent and said, we're going to work together and we're going to do this. I think he took the former instead of the latter. And the Republicans are faced with the same thing, of course. They can choose to say, well, now we're going to push our agenda down everybody's throat and, you know, probably get vetoed and we're override. That was one way to go. But I thought what Mitch McConnell said today, did you see his press conference?
I did not.
It was fascinating. He said exactly what you said, which was, and actually, Kevin.
I did actually. I did not see the president. I did see the new majority leader.
And he said pretty much what you just said, which is we're going to go forward and work on the stuff that we can agree with. I think where I disagree with Kevin a little bit, what he said earlier, is I believe out of the box, we're going to see agreement on things they can agree on, like the corporate tax rate being lowered because we're the highest in the industrial world. I think there will be an agreement on immigration reform. But then it comes to a screeching halt, and we're faced with Obamacare and some other
Obama has been after trade negotiation authority, and I think the Republicans support him on that.
Right.
I think
we'll see TTIP. We'll move forward.
Which is TTIP?
TTIP, you're the Republican businessman. I'm just the Democratic hack. It's a trade agreement dealing with the transatlantic.
That is yet another trade activity. And I can tell you, I think that our allies are delighted. our European allies are delighted with it. Now they're not going to say that publicly, but they have been biting their nails over whether or not the transatlantic trade partnership which we're just talking about is actually going to be enacted. Okay. And under when Harry Reid was running the Senate, there was no chance it would get enacted because of Harry Reid's ties to various labor organizations.
Labor actually is much more comfortable with TTIP than they were with NAFTA. And labor has been labor does have an understanding, and there is lots of opportunity. A lot of what will happen is numerous standards that are European standards now for the labor practices would also then be adopted.
Well, let's look at it briefly. What, in fact, does TTIP do by way of innovation?
Well, I think it is an opportunity for us to solidify our trade relationship with Europe.
It reduces or it regulates tariffs and trade barriers to create a more open and, I would say, unified marketplace across the Atlantic Ocean so that Canada, the United States, and I believe Mexico are able to deal directly with Europe without the current regime of regulation, tariffs, and obstacles. So it is something that they have been significantly interested in. Germany has been pushing this very, very hard, and they've got a variety of diplomatic and public affairs outreach activities going on. The UK has been pushing this very hard. I think France supports. So this is really a pan-European issue, and it was stalled. Now, so I'm just coming in on the back of Scott's point, which I think is also, we're all on the same page that there's got to be some movement. There's got to be some agreement. There's got to be an identification of a half a dozen issues where I think it is in both sides' interests, the Republicans and President Obama, to say, oh, look, in the first 100 days of the Republican Congress, we got these six things done. And then I think there's going to be a divergence when we get to something a little more substantive, whether that is Obamacare. And I want to amend my remarks if I said this. I agree with Kevin that the open process of revising and improving Obamacare should take place before any votes are taken to, quote, repeal.
You all remember a former Republican Speaker of the House who, in campaigning, promised America a list, was it of 10 or 12 innovations that would be pursued immediately upon the next Congress being sworn in. Are the current, the Republican majority in the House, and for that matter in the Senate, are they likely to try to do the same thing, systematically run down at least 6 or 7 major innovations?
I don't think out of
major
the
initiatives.
They don't seem to. They certainly didn't run on them. And one of the knocks against the Republicans who ran and won this time is that they ran strict and won because they were not Barack Obama or the party of Barack Obama. There wasn't a contract with America in this instance, and I don't know that there's that the Republicans can agree on an agenda that would come to more than 3 or 4 points.
Well, what is their point? Do they have any consensual convergence with regard to what I take to be one of the basic issues, namely immigration reform? I was rather stunned during the last month or so that various people on the right, including some talk show hosts and some of the right-wing locations on the internet, were telling us that the president was after 32 million green cards to be used for illegal immigrants. That could not have been the case.
I saw that same story, and it couldn't have been the case. I'm not sure where that came from or what the source of that story
was. But it does suggest that there's going to be an awful lot of legalization of a lot of people if the president had his way.
Yeah, I think that the president is... I think they've already written it. I think that he is now going to go through a rundown of events prior to signing it. I think he sees that as part of his legacy.
Well, what's the it, Chris?
I think he will change the status. I think he will take administrative action to change the status of a large number of undocumented residents of the United States. And they are going to go from, and I don't know all of the technical designations of these status conditions, but he is going to make people essentially, I mean, it seems to me, he's going to give them almost permanent resident status. So people who would otherwise be waiting for a green card to be a permanent resident, legal permanent resident, that's going to be sort of bestowed upon them with his pen and his phone.
Can he do this by executive action, or does he need compliance from both houses?
I think that's going to be the great battle that'll be fought.
Well,
I think he's comfortable. He is a learned person. He studies his options well, maybe even overstudies them. And if this is a battle he's willing to take on, I will follow him into that battle.
When he was hanging around the University of Chicago, where I spied him once or twice, as a mere quote professor of constitutional law, he supposedly knew a fair amount about the Constitution. But I wonder, does the Constitution, properly interpreted, even by the current Supreme Court, does it allow him to do this by executive fiat?
That is a massive question, and I have to imagine that when he does things like this, and he also talks about other executive orders, it's going to go to court, and you could potentially see, and it depends on your viewpoint, I think this might be a good thing, the diminishment of executive power as in the American government as it's constructed, right, and understood today. And this is after 50 years of it being built upon and built upon and built upon.
You know, and I mean, this is service to a constituency. And obviously, I think every sober person alive sees this as a step towards getting voting rights to these individuals on the theory that they will forevermore, and they and their progeny will forevermore support the Democratic Party. And I think I think the legacy ends up being Obamacare, immigration, and the nuclear deal with Iran. And as for the statutory or the constitutional basis, I do know that there is a fair amount of discretion vested by Congress in the executive branch on individual cases. I don't know if that translates into this kind of plenary categorical power over literally millions of cases.
Are we talking about 35 million? Are we talking about a number that large?
No, not that large. So. 32 no, no, million was what they spoke
about.
I think we're talking about 14 million or something like 15 million. You know, that's yet another element of this. It's very hard to sort of pin down exactly who we're talking about by the nature of the circumstances that they inhabit.
Mm-hmm. But what always frustrates me about this issue is why we don't spend more time talking about the businesses that hire undocumented workers and why we are not spending more time enforcing that and making life difficult for the businesses that hire undocumented workers. If that was the case, our food would cost more, our hotel rooms would cost more, various other parts of our economy would cost more, but we wouldn't be having this discussion today. And I think it's where the Republicans have been a little disingenuous in their own base by not going after the reason why there are so many undocumented workers because a business is hiring them and paying them.
Isn't it, in fact, part of the background picture, and that's part of the historical reality, that the last Republican president wasn't too worried about undocumented workers being in the workforce? He rather thought, you remember George W.'s line, that they are willing to do the work that Americans don't want to do.
Well, of course, like drawing immigration legislation, apparently. The Republicans, in terms of the Republican track record, it was Ronald Reagan, who I think last had how many?
Yeah.
How many did he pardon?
6 or 7 million?
Yeah. So this has happened before. And it just seems to me there's a practical solution to this problem, and nobody's willing to address it. And for the reasons I think Kevin touches on, one that's very practical. People, landscapers, construction, they like cheap labor. Hotelery, and that comes into the discussion about cost of labor, which, of course, I think is the overriding issue that no one is talking about in this country right now.
Well, this is a vexing. I mean, this is only a prelude to the national debate that will ensue executive action. But I want to make I may be agreeing here with Kevin in this element, but slightly stated differently. Everyone in this country ought to understand that by not defending our border, by not regulating who got in, we were indirectly welcoming these folks in. And I think that to stand up and to sort of treat them as common criminals and to not understand that they both came here out of a human need and we welcomed them because of an economic need. I mean, not to understand some of these basic human elements. Now, this is not true of the Zeta gang member who is waiting, who is hiding under a bush in Colorado because he doesn't want to be picked up by the federales in Nogales. He doesn't qualify for this sort of benign view. But this issue, I think, really calls into question our identity, our contemporary identity as a nation.
I think if we Republicans and Democrats admit it, that they are both participants in the need for immigration and undocumented workers. And the Democrats, we're willing to admit and understand that these workers are undocumented. But I don't hear from Republicans saying, you know what, we take some responsibility because our constituency that we care a lot about, just like you referred to a constituency, Chris, that we care about in Latino voters and other immigrant voters, no matter what their nationality may be. But I'm not hearing from Republicans saying, you know what, we bear some responsibility for this. And that would be a huge step forward in creating a space and creating an atmosphere for dialogue. But right now, from the Republicans, we don't hear that. And you need, those are some of the rhetorical things that we need.
I think you have heard that because if Ronald Reagan gave us, and he did, Simpson-Mazzoli, right, wrong, good, bad, but Ronald Reagan was that, that's how that happened. George W. Bush, whatever else you or any may say of him, 2006, he came out with his immigration. And I think that it was a reasonable, well thought through, and he was excoriated by grassroots Republicans. That was really one of the big starts of the Tea Party.
But that is the test of leadership, because as a leader, when you're elected to office, yes, you're there to do the people's bidding, but you're also there to do your own bidding. You're not elected I'm a firm believer in electoral office, no matter what it may be, whether it's chapter president of your college fraternity or you're president of the United States. You're elected to use your judgment, not just reflect the views of the people that elected you. Because sometimes what you may think and you may understand as the person that sits in that job, it becomes different than what you knew as a candidate. And so it requires sometimes for leadership to be able to say, you know what, main constituency, you know what, grassroots people, you don't understand this. And I'm using bold, blunt terms here. You don't understand it. I understand this. We may need to look at this differently. And we may need to change this discussion. And if there were Republican leaders who got up and started to say, we need to look at immigration from both sides of the issue on a consistent basis. Who in the last year on Republican leadership?
I'll tell you.
Who has said it?
Paul Ryan. I thought you were there at the City Club. Maybe you weren't there that
no.
day. Paul Ryan and Luis Gutierrez.
I just pay taxes in his district.
Paul Ryan and Luis Gutierrez, two congresspeople, one from New York, one from Chicago and one from southeast Wisconsin, came to the City Club of Chicago last July or something, and they had a terrific two-person presentation.
But they're not being amplified. You know, this is not the part of the immigration discussion that's happening on right-wing media, and that you're not talking to the constituents that you need to talk to. You're talking to the choir when you're at City Club.
To complete that record, Paul Ryan and Luis Gutierrez. And another sort of odd couple on the Senate side had actually been going around and went to something like 25 cities around the country
right.
saying this.
And there's blowback, obviously, from the right. Mark Rubio is one who tried to very reasonably, sensibly
right.
come forward with an immigration. Let's talk about immigration. And he was shouted down from both sides, by the way. So it's one of those issues that get people very excited. It's very emotional. It gets votes.
Well, he was rather like a high school debater. One part of Rubio's plan was we don't allow them into citizenship until they learn English. We test them for their competency in the English language. That's not serious.
No, of course not. I can tell you my Lithuanian and French family coming through Ellis Island would not have passed that test. And, well, I'd be living in France, which actually sounds pretty nice, Milt. It's one of those issues, and let's backtrack a little bit and go back to your original point. If the president tomorrow says, I'm going to essentially change these people's status, it is going to be a poop storm of unimaginable proportions, and it is going to blot out anything else that we talk about. And there's really important stuff to talk about in this country right now.
Well, I'm going on to another thing important to talk about, though we ventilated this one very nicely, and we've not resolved it clearly, and it's going to be a major issue for the remaining 2 years of this presidency and probably beyond. But also, a very simple and in some ways a more discreet issue is the question of the Keystone XL oil pipeline, which lots of people have been advocating for some time. It's there, just about ready to go. The president says no, absolutely no. And also, as part of his general negative on energy, he also says no more coal. And that made a big hit down in Kentucky.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, coal is the thing about America and coal is we have a lot of it.
Yeah.
And we burn a lot of electricity in this country. So we need it. It's essential. Can we put money towards development of burning as cleanly as we can? Yes, we can. Is that really, really hard? Absolutely. Am I having a conversation with myself? Apparently I am.
Are the Republicans now going to preside over the opening of the XL pipeline? Should they?
Can they do that? Now, whose authority is that, Kevin?
It is. You know, if they send a bill, the president's probably going to veto it. The president's going to stand firm.
Can you override the veto?
They don't have the votes. No. Democrats to join them, I don't think they'll have the votes.
That's what I was wondering, of course. There will be Democrats on their side as well.
I'm not so sure. I mean, it depends. You know, I can tell you, let's just say that we've got, if we have 53 today, we're going to end up with 55. The Republicans, if the Republicans have 53 today, they will get, well, I guess they've got Alaska, so that gets you to 54.
Mm-hmm.
And then Louisiana is going to come Republican because Senator Landrieu down there is stuck, mired in the mid to low 40s. And when you get the Republican and the independent or libertarian guy together, whether you get those votes together, she's going to be wiped out. So that then gets you into the question about overriding vetoes, et cetera, et cetera. But here is one thing. This could be an example. First of all, if we don't do it, and I don't think the president has ever said definitively, "I'm against it." He's
not been as strong as some of the environmental left would like him to be.
Right, and he left it open for the likes of Senator Landrieu and others. But the point comes back to part of what the Republicans have to do in the next 2 years is to decide what bill they're going to be putting on the desk in front of Obama. So here's a bill that says yes to the Keystone Pipeline. At that point, apart from the actual public impact, which in the case of the XL pipeline is pretty significant, but apart from that, politically, they then have Obama over a barrel because he's either going to sign it and that's a win for them, or he's going to veto it and they've got their issue. They can say, look, we passed the bill. He vetoed it. It's his fault. Okay. So right now, that seems to be a natural occurrence of that. But they have to start thinking about those issues that they're going to use to delineate the difference between generally understood the Republicans and the Democrat. Same thing goes for President Obama. It's what he referred to today in his press conference. He said, I'm going to take executive actions that I'm sure they're not going to like. And he has to be, in my two cents, he needs to be judicious about those, because he will be setting up not just his own legacy, but also the basis for his Democratic successor or the candidate to succeed him. And so that's very important for his side.
As to his Democratic successor, it's just a sidebar issue in a way, but it's also been in the news. We're told by close observers that Mrs. Clinton did herself no good, indeed injured her very opportunity for the nomination down in her almost home state of Arkansas.
Not just Arkansas, but across the country, every candidate she campaigned for lost.
Lost.
Every single one. I think that is, well, hilarious. And
what's that all about?
I think it speaks to, she does not have the gravitas that her husband has for a myriad of reasons, not least of which is I don't think she's a good candidate. And she doesn't have the charisma or the charm that he does. And so it didn't bring people to those candidates that she campaigned for.
See, I think there was, you cannot blame the loss of those candidates on Secretary Clinton or on who campaigned for them. I think their losses hang on their own heads. The Democrats did not do as good a job as selecting candidates this cycle as we've done in the past, nor were we given the gifts that the Republicans did in the last cycle. With pushing and putting out more far right wing, you have all of a sudden a lot of candidates moving very quickly to the center, as most Republican candidates did this cycle, to get elected. But also we were in states that were clearly red states. This was the worst possible group of states for the Democrats to come out victorious. I actually think. Secretary Clinton's chances for the presidency were increased because the more she gets battle hardened as a candidate, the better she's going to be. She still needs some development as a candidate in order to take on the next presidential race.
I think as a loyal Democrat, you have done the absolute best, Kevin, that you possibly can. But I want to say the Democratic Party, quite honestly,
I think I did it intellectually, too. I don't think it's just me being a Democrat.
Okay.
I think it's, granted, I don't have a degree from, Eastern.
Oh, cut that.
And I went to Western Illinois. I know that I'm not intellectually respected in this town, but.
Yes.
No, I want to say the Democrats knew that they couldn't run on their record. And so they created a four-issue matrix: racism, sexism, homophobia, and as far as I can tell, the minimum wage, and I'm only partially kidding when I say that.
No,
I think that they
right.
were the Democrats were reduced as, for lack of a better term, Rome is burning. Now, in fact, Rome was not burning. The economy has actually been getting a little bit better. It's just been getting better at such a slow rate. It's been getting better at such an anemic pace that if you ask people, the latest Fox News poll with Roper or somebody, right track, wrong direction. Wrong direction was something like 66%. And so instead of dealing with those issues, they chose to go the route of the war on women. And they chose to go the route of, you know, exclusion as opposed to diversity. And they chose to go the route of sexism, or I'm sorry, and racism. I mean, that was the Ferguson thing. So I think that Hillary was playing the hand that was dealt to all Democrats. All Democrats lost. I don't think, you know, just like we've come back from terrible defeats, the Democrats can come back from this terrible defeat. But I don't think this helps her one single bit in her bid to become president.
Do you think a challenge will come from the newest senator from Massachusetts?
I can speak to that.
Please.
Actually, you know, in actually from knowing what's going on, if Hillary does not run from, you know, I mean, I have a relationship. If Hillary does not run, Elizabeth Warren is ready to step in.
Is she ready to step in even if Hillary runs? Because I know a lot of friends on the left really want her to.
No, I think she will hold off. She's learned a lot in the past couple of years and grown a much better understanding of politics.
What commends her? Her professorship at Harvard Law or her Indian origins?
It's her Native American background.
Yes, yeah. that always brings in the votes. I think it's her progressive notions, and I think that she is, I perceived by many of my friends on the left, as having true progressive bona fides, where Hillary is viewed as
a moderate. She's a centrist.
Yeah.
You know, and so is Barack Obama. I mean, these people are centrists, they're moderates. They're not as far left as certainly I am.
Well, what are true progressive bona fides? Your term, define it. Specify it. What does it really mean?
Tax the rich, regulate the heck out of businesses, things of that nature. I mean, particularly economic issues, social issues, which I think social issues, frankly, are non-starters because they're pretty much decided now. I think gay marriage.
Because the left fought so hard and made sure that they were decided.
Okay. Well, whoever gets the credit or blame for that those are they're non-starters now. So now it becomes an economic battle. It becomes I touched on this earlier. Price of labor continues to be the debate that people aren't having in this country, and we need to have it. The gulf between rich and poor, which is growing, which the diminishment of the middle class, stuff like that, and the solutions to that. You know, Chris and I would see free market solutions to those. I don't want to speak for him, but I imagine Kevin would see a statist response to that, and that would be the progressive side.
I think that the threshold between liberalism and leftism, which I think, Milt, is what you were asking us. Is that right?
I am indeed.
Okay. So liberalism, I think liberalism is essentially what we would refer to as a social democratic agenda relative to income support and transfer payments. So that, you know, health insurance or retirement insurance, a social security scheme, the social safety net, more or less to me, is liberalism. And leftism, right, is another step beyond that. And leftism is a point at which folks are prepared to use government not just to provide for the least in society or for the least capable in society for whatever reason, but leftism is a use of government to impose essentially value preferences of governing elites.
Was Barack
like the Civil Rights Act then? I mean, you know, those were the Civil Rights Act in the 60s. Those were attacks against the elite. And Democrats and the left fought for that.
The
Dixocrats. But Lyndon Johnson made it happen.
Republicans fought for those, and Republicans enabled those. And that is the absolute truth. And I think the Republican civil rights.
We're talking about liberals here. We're not talking about Democrats. We're talking about liberals.
I think that is respect for That is an expansion of civil rights. That is not Dodd-Frank telling commercial banks what you may and may not do.
Now, hold on. I seek basic clarification. Liberalism and leftism. In which category did and does Barack Obama belong?
Oh, I think he's a leftist.
You think he's truly a leftist?
He might be a near leftist and not a far leftist, but I think that he is definitely a man of the left.
He told us to vote on his program. This election is about what I've done. It's about my program.
Right.
What was leftist and what is leftist in his program?
Right.
And by the way, is anything left of his leftism?
I think, unfortunately, we heard this afternoon, there's much left of his leftism. And I think the principal leftism of Barack Obama was expressed in this absolute refusal with Obamacare to consider the empowerment of individuals. There's this terrible fear that leftists have of dispensing vouchers to people and saying, you can now go make your own choices. The way that, say, Milton Friedman wrote about the negative income tax,
under the system of healthcare that existed in the Bush era, I did not have that choice.
Yeah, I'm the real example.
I understand that. And you constantly want to take away rights from me.
That's not true.
And yes, you do, Chris. You'd rather see me die than receive this health care.
That's not true.
And because particularly,
you and I have had this conversation in front of other people, and I do not take
and
that.
So,
I don't exalt the latter-day George Bush health arrangement of the United States as a preference over Obamacare. That's just false.
But if Obamacare gets repealed, I lose my health care.
Not necessarily because...
Yes.
But no.
You know, you're really worrying me about your health. I don't know what your reference was.
I'm fat and I have hypertension. Of course I'm going to die soon. Every one of my grandparents died in their 50s of cancer.
We don't want that to happen.
But this is the real life that happens, though. This is where the rubber meets the road. And this is what we need. Because we use these words to attack each other.
No. A guy like me... In response to the situation you describe, taking personalities out of it, I prefer for you to decide what to do about your health care with the support of federal government dollars. And that's not what you have under Obamacare.
I'm so worried about Kevin. I can't stand the tension. So I'm going to shift to something quite different, something we haven't talked about.
Talk about ISIS, yes.
You know, Kevin, I am a few years older than you. And what comes to mind is the great saying, a great Caesar's bust is on the shelf, and I don't feel so good myself. We've not yet gone abroad at all.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, goodness.
Surely there's a lot on the foreign policy agenda, which is kind of messy these days. One immediate item is that many of our military say, we got to go back in there being Iraq.
Iraq. You know, one of the things I suggested in an editorial board meeting with the Chicago Tribune is that we should go back in with some numbers and shove them all into Syria and let Assad deal with this, in which at least it regains the Mosul and other refineries.
Are the Republicans in the Senate going to care and going to act on anything
Milt,
like that?
That's a tough thing about. I mean, if you're Senator Rosenberg, would you vote in your district or congressman? Would the people in the mothers in your district want you to say, okay, we're going back in. We're going to put not just capital and we're not going to put treasure, but we're going to put life in your kid's life to do this. Now, that's a harder sell. And we've had 10 years experiencing war that seems to be bottomless. I'm not sure this country has the resolve, and it's curious because this seems to be the war we should have been fighting, and it's a very, very, I'm wrapping myself in knots here, and I apologize for that. It's a difficult sale, but I think you have to do it.
What do we do about Russia? What do we do about China? Both of them are acting ambitiously, if not aggressively.
Well, China's...
In ways that threaten or challenge our interests.
Look what China's doing in the South China Sea with property of the Philippines, islands that are claimed by Japan. This is a powder keg, and we are doing nothing. This is this administration's, and this is the glaring weakness of this administration. You have Putin invading, parts of
this is the Cairo speech. We're guilty of a great deal, and we're going to be nice to the rest of the world.
Precisely, and he'll go and apologize to the Ukrainians at some point. But right now, our allies don't trust us. They don't believe us. They don't believe this administration has the courage or the stamina or the backbone to do what it says it's going to do and what needs to be done. And the people, frankly, our adversaries don't respect us.
So is the Republican difference going to make a difference?
I don't know if it can. Policy? Legislatively, I don't know if it can.
I think these are areas that we actually need to start talking to each other, not at each other. I advise a political party in Ukraine. I advise political parties in Africa. The Chinese are the biggest problem in Africa right now. America needs to be focused on what's going on there because China is creating instability, economic instability, and they're taking advantage of the natural resources and destroying the lands and destroying the people as well. In the Ukraine, Putin is out of control. And we need to kill our rhetoric around these hotspots and actually sit down and have an intellectual discussion about what can be done. I actually could be fairly hawkish on ISIS. I know from work that I do in Albania, Kosovo, and Macedonia that ISIS is recruiting in those regions. I know people that have been recruited who are going over and fighting in Syria. These are regions, Albania, Macedonia, and Albania, where we can desperately be very influential. When I go and work with political parties in that region, I'm introduced from the stage, and the people chant USA, USA as I'm being brought to the stage. These are predominantly Muslim countries, and these are allies that we need to be taken care of, and that we need to be economically participating in Eastern Europe. And we need to be economically participating in Africa. And if we were to step up those things and get American businesses to understand the opportunities that exist for markets in those places, you want to talk free markets, those are the two of the biggest markets in the world right now.
So it's not a military area of concern. It's essentially corporate.
Well, I think you may be surprised to hear this. I'm someone who is comfortable with drone attacks. I just think of it as another advancement in technology in war. People probably were mad when we went from horses to cars or to tanks, or went from swords to guns. These are all things, but these are what it takes, and I can be supportive of the president. Now, I wish there wasn't, I think we need to regulate and understand what these drone attacks are doing, but in principle, I'm supportive.
But don't you think, I don't believe this is an unfair accusation that Putin... In his adventurism now he's kind of looking at the Baltic states, and as a Lithuanian, Lithuanian-American, catches my attention. But what he did in Ukraine, what he did in Georgia, wasn't he emboldened by an administration he knew he could get away with this?
I completely disagree with you that Putin would have been empowered no matter who the American president was.
He did not do it under George W. Bush.
He didn't have. He had the opportunity.
With Georgia, later in the...
Right. He did it in Georgia. Right.
And he had a golden opportunity. And when I was trying to get the United States more involved in what was going on in Ukraine, we saw Putin coming. Putin didn't care who the president was. Well, he was going to come in no matter what.
Okay. I think that it is hard to deny that our foreign policy has been muddied at best since President Obama took his first oath of office. It has been muddied such that what Scott said, I believe to be the case. Our adversaries do not fear us, and our friends do not trust us. And I think that the administration, unfortunately, has acted precipitously with respect to Iraq, with respect to Afghanistan, with respect to Iran. And I think it's gone into all kinds of bad places, and we're seeing some, and only some, of the consequences of those precipitate acts. I think that globally... President Obama, for whatever reason, has chosen to absent the United States from day in, day out sort of interactions of states. And I believe, and this is somewhat in agreement, I think, with what both of you have said, that in response to that, folks like China, folks like Putin have taken advantage and they see openings and they are claiming what they can. And I think that it's late in the Obama administration to come up with a foreign policy, to come up with a correlative strategy, let alone to come up with effective and affordable tactics. But when you're facing something like ISIS or ISIL or Daesh or whatever they're calling it now, I agree that it is an imminent threat to the security of the United States. And I believe that there are lone wolves out in out among us, and we ought to be doing everything we can right now to destroy as much of it as we possibly can.
Gentlemen, we are almost out of time. And indulge me, please, if I ask the impossible of you within the next 3 or 4 minutes. Take the position of a philosopher of history and looking backwards towards this time and explain to me and explain to yourself and to your colleagues what happened this year that was inevitable and what was open to choice and where were the right or the wrong choices made.
This was the year that the American people decided that they were uncomfortable on a rudderless ship of state.
I'm frustrated by the lack of participation of Americans in the process, whether it be to participate in the argument or participate within the act of voting. This constantly is a problem for me. I consider that we have actually three political parties in America. We have the Democrats, the Republicans, and the I Don't Vote Party.
And the, right not the now, know-nothings, but the do-nothings.
And right. And those and the two political parties right now are doing everything they can to increase the size of the I don't vote party.
I think that philosopher, Milt, that you described would say that this was a year, a significant marker of a departure, of a significant marker of a true end to a 20th century post-war liberalism and statism, in which across the board, at all levels, people registered doubts about an ongoing government model that was dependent on ever higher taxes to fund ever more generous public employee contracts. I think that is probably the single biggest characteristic of what happened. And that makes Scott Walker, just got to throw this in, Scott Walker's reelection is the single most significant historic event of yesterday.
I must ask quickly why.
Because the left promised us not once, not twice, not three times, not four times, but more than five times that it would destroy Scott Walker. And I mean, people in my face were screaming, their eyes were bulging, their veins were pulsing. And they said, he will be dirt under our shoes. We will stand on his neck until dead. And he is reelected. And they, all of those guys up in Wisconsin and ladies up in Wisconsin, promised us that they were going to stand up for ever increasing government with ever more generous contracts. That was the link that Walker, Senate Bill number 10, broke, and it is a watershed. It goes beyond the tax revolt of 1978 that propelled Ronald Reagan into the White House.
I turn to Scott Stantis to give us the final judgment on everything we've been talking about so far. What have you learned tonight? Or what is urgently required to be said by you, which you've not yet been able to say?
I think I've said it all. I think we have learned that the American people want something to be done. They want the problems of the country to be addressed in a serious manner and in a forceful manner. There's a danger that someone will step forward with bad ideas forcefully said, and we'll put that person in the ascent. That's a danger, and we better watch out for that.
And with Tiny Tim, we can all pray, God bless us, everyone.
Amen.
We may need it.
Amen.
Thank you so much for an excellent conversation.